Life Management Science Labs would like to acknowledge that we live and produce this podcast on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. We'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands of our listeners and our international colleagues. We'd like to thank and pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Hi, everyone, and welcome to On the House, the Household Management Science Insights podcast produced by LMSL, the Life Management Science Labs. We are champions of life management science, providing structured insights informed by science and inspired by practice on key aspects of conscious living. Each week, we bring you scientific and practical insights on each element with the expert knowledge of professionals in the field. I'm your host, Gabriella Yastra, coming to you from NAM, Melbourne, Australia. Let's begin. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the show. Today, we're going to be talking about clean air, understanding household air pollution from cooking. And we're talking to Dr. Matt Schuppler, who is a postdoctoral research fellow at the Department of Epidemiology at the Harvard Chan School of Public Health, and also a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Liverpool. Wow, that sounds like quite a lot of work. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you. Do you mind introducing yourself in a bit more detail so, you know, we get to know you a bit better?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. So my work, as you mentioned, is focused on clean air. And I would say my involvement in this topic kind of started about a decade ago. So I did my master's in Washington, D.C., and I was introduced to this topic there by my supervisor. And it was on a project based in Nigeria. And so that was kind of my introduction to global public health, which is kind of the realm that this research falls under. And so that was a great experience. And I decided to then pursue a PhD. And I focused a lot of my research, again, on household air pollution, which we'll be talking about on this podcast. From there, I did a lot of travels to low and middle income countries, predominantly in sub-Saharan Africa. So that was, you know, a great learning opportunity. I got to work with a lot of different communities, focused primarily on household air pollution and clean energy access. So that took several years for my PhD, and I actually did that in Canada, in Vancouver, Canada. So that was great to live there for a few years as well. And then, as you mentioned, I worked at the University of Liverpool in the UK. I never actually got to live there because of COVID-19, but it was also a great experience, and I've a lot of that has, we'll probably discuss my research on this podcast. And yeah, now I currently live in Boston in the US, working at Harvard as well. It's been a lot of traveling, which has been great. And I'm happy to discuss more about this topic.
Yeah, I'm so excited to talk to you about this. Travel around the world. So many different countries. But before we do get into the topic in a bit more detail, I like to do a section called Have You Met Matt, where we get to know you through some of your favorite things. The first thing I'd like to know is what is a movie that you've enjoyed recently?
Yeah, so I just saw a movie this previous weekend called Saltburn. It was kind of a dark comedy based in the UK, but I think something more relevant, which probably a lot of your listeners might have heard of, is Oppenheimer, which I saw this summer, and that was about the physicist, Dr. Oppenheimer, that made the first atomic bomb. I think that was an enjoyable movie just because it talked a lot, obviously, about that history, but then also just life as a scientist back then and all the hardships. And it was really admirable how persistent he was, because I think, you know, as scientists and researchers, we face a lot of hurdles, not just with the challenges of research, but all the other difficulties we face and pushbacks. So I think it was a really interesting movie, and I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. I don't know much about being a researcher, but do you think that, things have gotten a bit easier for scientists and researchers since, you know, Oppenheimer?
I think yes and no. I would say yes, just because of our technology and data. So we probably heard of terms like big data and accessibility. I mean, the possibilities are kind of endless now. So we have the opportunity to do more research and look at more novel questions. We have better technology, so we can use things like machine learning. So in that sense, we have a lot more opportunities. There are also still hurdles when it comes to sometimes lack of funding, which can be a result of what administration is in charge in a certain country and other hurdles. So it is a challenge sometimes to actually be able to fund your research and have build up your lab group. But once that's in place, you know, and you have a great team, then, you know, the sky's the limit. So I think, you know, there are exciting opportunities when it comes to, you know, data availability and the questions you can ask.
I guess you can't fix everything, but at least, you know, it's getting a bit easier.
Yeah, definitely.
And do you listen to any podcasts?
I listen to a lot of podcasts, yes. So I like anything generally related to science. So there's podcasts called like Science Weekly, which I think is run by The Guardian, Science Friday. There's some BBC podcasts. One is called Health Check, which is health focused. There's a lot of climate change podcasts. I think one is called The Climate Question. So I enjoy to learn about a variety of topics in science, not just like public health and air pollution. So yeah, I definitely enjoy a variety of podcasts.
Yeah. And I guess it's sort of an easier way to keep up with what's going on rather than having to read every single paper that comes out.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes I'll listen to like political podcasts, but sometimes that can be a little depressing, especially with the state of in the US. So yeah, it's nice to diversify in that. You can kind of know ahead of time what topic you're focused on. I like these podcasts that are focused on a singular topic. You can really delve in and learn a lot more versus just, you know, listening to a news program where it might be a 30-second, you know, tidbit. So yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Do you have a role model?
So I have several. I think one for me growing up, I'm a big tennis fan. So I followed Andre Agassi. He was an American tennis player. And then also just for his work off the tennis court. So he is very accomplished and won many major titles. But then after he stopped playing tennis, he started a charter school. I think we lived in Las Vegas and has funded, I think, over 80 schools for underprivileged children, I think, throughout the U.S. and maybe internationally. And so he's really had a big philanthropic component focused on education. And so I think he's very well-rounded and I admire his, you know, all his achievements. And I think that's something that I've tried to do with my work. As I mentioned, I've traveled to different communities and doing my best through my research to try to help them. That's really a motivation for me. So yeah, he was definitely an inspiration to me as a child and still is.
And it's great to see, I guess, you know, you've really taken, you know, his life and his work directly into, you know, how you're, you know, doing your life, trying to help people and try to, I guess, not just in one community, but also spreading your knowledge and everything to multiple communities and trying to help as many people as possible. That's amazing.
Yeah. And I think a big part of that also is just science communication and dissemination, which is part of what we're doing right now. So I also value your podcast. I think it's great that you have all these speakers and yeah, definitely to try to, you know, communicate all of the research beyond just these papers, right? And talk on podcasts or through other media. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. During my studies, you know, had to read a lot of papers, not my favorite thing to do. Now that I finished, haven't read one paper. So, but I still listen to podcasts and I still listen to, you know, I get as my work to listen to lots of really interesting people. So very much a privilege for me. And very much what we're trying to do is get this information out to people in a way that they can consume easily. And if they're interested, find out more by reading the papers.
Yeah, that's great. Fantastic.
Thank you. And has there been an individual or an experience that has inspired you?
Well, I think this kind of relates back to previously where I've mentioned my travels and traveling to the different communities. So I've been to several countries in sub-Saharan Africa over the years. It's been a great opportunity, but I mean, you see firsthand some of the extreme poverty and a lot of challenges that these populations face. You know, a lot of them have immediate concerns on a daily basis of being able to feed their families, and a lot of other stresses that I think we can't even imagine. And so to see their persistence, and I mean, today we're discussing household air pollution, that's just one of many of the challenges, whether it's food security or infectious disease or clean water. And so I think, as I mentioned, that's kind of a big motivation for me. And also, when I started in this work, when I lived in DC, my supervisor there did a lot of local community work focused on environmental justice and really advocating for the community, whether it's increased monitoring of air pollution. So that's really been an inspiration to me, is how we can try to use what we have at our disposal with technology and research and really try to help local communities. So I think that's really been my inspiration, why I've continued to work on this for several years.
Yeah, amazing. Thank you. I think that we forget how important clean air is, and particularly for, I guess, long-term health when, you know, we've got all these short-term problems that we're just trying to figure out as we go.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So making it easier, certainly takes the burden off a lot of people. But before we get started, I like to, you know, have some definitions so that we kind of know where we're starting. And the first thing I'd like to know is, how do you define household management?
Yeah, sure. I would say household management is how we take care of our home in a way that makes us feel comfortable, protects our health, both physical and mental health, and also just generating a space that we find livable for ourselves, our families, and anyone else that's, you know, sharing that space with us.
And I think that really cuts to what we're trying to talk about today with health, well-being, and livability is how household air pollution can affect us. So what is household air pollution, and, you know, how is it related to cooking?
Yeah, thanks for that. So a lot of times when we think of air pollution, we may think of air pollution outdoors. If we see it, I know, especially in Australia and the US, we've had forest fires when we think of outdoor ambient air pollution, but household air pollution, as in the name, is typically inside the household. And so this is pollution that can be generated from cooking. So in the news, I believe earlier this year, there was some stories about gas cooking and the emissions from that. And in low middle income countries, a lot of times they may not have access to gas or electricity. And so families will have to cook with wood, charcoal, coal, animal dung, crop waste, basically whatever's available locally. So if they live close to forests, they may gather wood, cook with that. It's really depends on what's available. And so they typically would just burn that in open fire or some inefficient stove. And so there could be poor ventilation. And so there's a lot of smoke generated. So it's kind of incomplete combustion. And so if this is done in your home, you can imagine if there's poor ventilation, the air pollution can get extremely, extremely high at levels that are orders of magnitude above what we may experience on a typical day, let's say outdoors where we live. So there's different organizations that have these guidelines for air pollution. One of the main metrics is something called fine particulate matter, or PM2.5, which some people might be familiar with. And so a lot of times we're looking at whether it's a dangerous day, and sometimes there's these air quality indices that's kind of usually based on PM2.5. But so household air pollution from cooking is when this pollution is generated inside the home at levels that can be dangerous to health.
I didn't imagine that people would be cooking with some of these materials like wood and things inside their homes. I would assume you'd do it outside, because I've been at a bonfire roasting marshmallows, and as the smoke drifts over to our side, we're all, you know, coughing, our eyes are stinging. And I'm like, I can't imagine cooking like that in a home where there's no ventilation. Do people do it at home? I guess that's a silly question, because obviously they do, but is it very common?
Yeah, no, it's not silly at all. I think it really depends. So in some countries, communities, they do cook outdoors, but sometimes, you know, they have a rainy season and they may not be able to, or sometimes there's kind of these built-in stoves of mud that are built into the corner of an indoor household, so they do cook indoors. In some countries as well, they'll have kind of a detached house or a smaller cooking area, so it's not completely part of the main home, but it's an enclosed area that they have their stove in, which can also maybe protecting from the rainy season. But you can imagine that's an even smaller space, and if there's no windows when the cook goes in there, it can be very polluted. And so yes, as you can imagine, whether if you're roasting marshmallows, you have the smoke that gets in your eyes, is coughing, and a lot of times we do research, all of the cooks there note that they don't really enjoy cooking because of that experience. They acknowledge that their eyes are burning, or tears, you know, down their face, or they're coughing constantly. So this is something they realize, but, you know, it's where they used to cook, where their families have cooked, and sometimes it may be the only space they have for cooking. And so, you know, they will cook indoors in some locations. And the prevalence can vary. I think also a lot of times people will change their cooking location based on time of year, depending on, you know, if it gets colder or, if the rains are coming. So they also may shift indoors versus outdoors.
Okay, yeah. And I guess I hadn't thought about how this would also affect enjoyment of cooking, because, you know, I think us in our, you know, beautiful homes with electric stovetops, we're like, oh, I have to cook today. Oh, I can't be bothered. Maybe I'll get takeaway. And, you know, we may enjoy it, we may not enjoy it, but it's completely not related to, you know, how we're physically feeling as we're actually doing the cooking. That's something I've never considered before. Wow.
Yeah. And something else too is like, we sometimes have a lot of appliances, right? We have an oven, we have a toaster, we have a stovetop, we have a microwave. In a lot of cases, they may only have that one fire to cook everything, right? So it takes a long time. Like for us, we can just put something in the microwave or heat it up really quickly and control the flame. With a fire, you know, it's not as controllable, right? So also cooking can be a lot more labor intensive because you have to let something cook for a longer period. So it's also something that you may not have as much control over as well.
Wow. Yeah. So that's concerning. And so, you know, what has your research kind of looked at how you can improve, particularly in these places that don't have access maybe to as much appliances, electricity as we do?
Yeah, there's a lot of research in this area, and I think it really depends on the location. There's been also a lot of national programs, which I can talk very briefly. But a lot of the push has been on something called liquefied petroleum gas. So it's not like piped gas, like we may be used to, but actually gas in canisters or cylinders. So you could think of like a propane tank for a barbecue, because those, you don't really need infrastructure. You can just disseminate them at shops. And so there's been a large push by several countries. I think the most recent has been India, to really expand access to LPG, because even though it is a gas stove and there are some emissions, as was just covered in the media earlier this year, the emissions are much lower usually than other what we can call solid fuels or polluting fuels, as I mentioned, like wood, coal, or charcoal. So you can definitely reduce exposure to household air pollution with gas. I think electricity is the cleanest because there are no emissions from electricity. However, for that, you would need some sort of grid infrastructure, solar, off-grid. A lot of times that may not be possible. And so LPG may be seen as this short to medium term solution. And so there's a big push, as I mentioned, India. In sub-Saharan Africa, it's much more prevalent. I believe about maybe 10% of households will cook with LPG, or up to 15%, whereas electricity for cooking is only about 1%. You know, obviously with in sub-Saharan Africa, like solar can be a great source, because if they're living there, there's a lot of sun in a tropical climate, but we just need to focus on getting the right technology and scaling up, you know, grid electricity or off-grid. And then also other big challenge that's kind of embedded in this is the culture of cooking. So a lot of times if you say, oh, cook, you know, with this electric stove, they'll say, oh, well, my grandma or my family cooked, you know, made our local foods on this charcoal stove. I like the smoky flavor. I can't get that same taste. It doesn't taste as good on a gas stove or electric stove. So that's also a challenge. But I think the big push is for gas in the medium term, and then ultimately electricity, and maybe even powered by renewables.
Yeah. Would it be realistic, I guess, to move straight from, you know, those solid fuels to electric, or we really need that intermediate gas stage?
Yeah, no, I think it is possible to leapfrog, and that's what big push is where we can. I think that's great, because I, as much electricity as possible, because that's renewable and that will contribute less to climate change. So whenever possible, I think we should, and I think communities can. There is access to electricity in some countries. I think South Africa is kind of leading the way right now, but then they've had some issues with load shedding and a lack of reliability. So the other issue, right, is if you're powered by solar, you need to have storage, because otherwise you may not be able to cook when you want. So I think the technology is can improve, and it is possible in some areas, but I think, you know, in some cases we may need to use this kind of transition fuel, which can be LPG or possibly ethanol. And so, yeah, I think LPG is a way to reduce exposures immediately, because, you know, if we wait till we have electricity access, there's going to be a lot more health concerns if people just don't switch to less polluting fuel. So I think in terms of, we think of public health, switching people to LPG in the interim is a good solution, because it can reduce their exposure to household air pollution.
Yeah. But you also mentioned that there are some health concerns with LPG. You know, so that, you know, we know what to look for and how to mitigate them. Do you mind explaining what those, you know, health concerns are?
Yeah, so there are some emissions from LPG. So as I mentioned, there is some fine particulate matter, which is this PM2.5. The concentrations are much, much lower, but as we've seen from other studies, that even low concentrations can still be a health hazard. The main concern, I think, with LPG is also NO2 or nitrogen dioxide. So that's also released with the burning of gas. And typically, if you're in a home and you have your gas stove running and there may be no ventilation, closed windows, you can have elevated levels of NO2 or nitrogen dioxide in your household, which that can be a contributor to asthma in some cases. And that's what some of the media coverage was. So that can be a concern. I think it's all kind of based on the context. So if you don't have access to electricity, I think LPG is your best source of cooking, because your other option would be wood or charcoal. But if you do have access to electricity, I recommend cooking with that over gas, because there are no emissions. And if you are cooking with gas, try to use ventilation like a fan, a hood, and try to open windows if possible, if it's not too cold out, because that can also kind of dilute your exposure.
Mm-hmm. And does that include, households where gas has been, I guess, piped in rather than just the takeaways, as you were explaining before?
Yeah. So the emissions kind of come when it's burned at the source. So regardless of, if you have it in a cylinder or it's piped in, the gas, there is still that harm to your health when you are burning. So when you light up your stove and you have the flame, there are emissions. And the thing about PM2.5 is it's 2.5 microns. It's super small. You can't actually see it. It's about 1/20th the size of a human hair. So we kind of think of air pollution, we imagine this plume of wildfire smoke, but really dangerous particles are actually not visible to the human eye. And even gases like NO2, you can't actually see them. So even if you may not see something, you can have levels very high. And this has been kind of tested in some studies where they'll place these monitors that can measure that in homes. We do see levels very high. So yeah, it is possible even with piped gas.
Okay. I'm moving into a home with piped gas. And as you were saying, that there's been quite a lot of media coverage recently about some of the health consequences of gas. And I'm like, oh, maybe I should ask my landlord to change it, but I don't know how to ask them.
Yeah, another kind of immediate solution if your landlord doesn't want to change it, because we know how dealing with landlords can be sometimes, is you can purchase an induction stove. And those can be pretty cheap, maybe like $40, $50. And you could buy like a single plate or a double burner, and that you kind of just plug into an outlet, and you could use that as another option. I know I would do that if I didn't have access to an electric stove. And so the technology is getting, I feel like, cheaper all the time. So that can be an alternative option, even to supplement some of your cooking. So if you want to do some of that on the induction stove, and I've cooked with induction before and it is pretty efficient and nice to work with. So yeah, that's another option if you don't want to completely swap out the gas stove.
Yeah. And what are some other tips that you have to improve out, air quality?
Yeah. So I think there are opportunities in your household. So, if you are cooking, as I mentioned, you have ventilation. So use a fan, a hood, and try not to kind of like linger over for as long as possible, because the emissions, if they are getting diluted. So that's one option. There's also options, which we hear about during forest fires, is to have air purifiers in your home. So those are another option as well. If you have to cook with gas or another fuel that's not emissionless, like electric. In some cases, if you're going outdoors, particularly wearing a mask. So the same way we wore masks for COVID, those masks that protect against viruses can also protect against these air particles. So we've seen people wear them outside, during times of forest fires. So that can be a way to protect yourself if going outside, it's a particularly hazardous day. If there's wildfire, you have different alerts on your phone that there's a high air quality index. So also wearing a mask can be efficient at filtering out some of those dangerous particles.
That does remind me, my mom, we had Chinese New Year dinner at my house this year, and there's this one dish, steamed fish, where you heat up oil really hot and then you pour it over the fish. And my mom forgot about it and it caught fire. And so there was three of us in the kitchen kind of panicking. But when you enter the kitchen, you actually immediately start coughing. And I was like, what do I do? What do I do? And I immediately grabbed some like N95 masks I had from COVID, and I gave them to everyone so that at least we could deal with the oil fire without, you know, coughing and spluttering and, maybe spilling oil, hot oil on ourselves. So glad to know it's the right thing to do. But that also brings up, you know, so some foods can also create some, you know, things that make us cough, you know, obviously when you burn something. But how does the actual like food that we're cooking impact the air quality?
Yeah, so it kind of depends on like the method. So if you're like frying something, you know, that can also generate more emissions or certain types of gases that are released. And so there is some evidence. I haven't really focused on that in my research, but the type of cooking can also affect the type of pollutants in the air. And some of the research we've done also has looked at cooking among street food vendors. So some people whose job is to cook. So you can imagine if you're cooking all day that your exposures can be even higher. So the type of food you're cooking and how hot it is and type of methods. So if you're frying in oil, like you mentioned, that can also generate higher emissions. So yeah, that also plays a role as well in addition to the type of fuel you're using.
Interesting. And this might be a old wives tale or like just a rumor that I've heard, but I was told that a lot of Chinese chefs get like nose cancer because of the way that they cook. It's very high heat, a lot of oil. I tried Googling it. I couldn't find much, but do you think that sounds about right? Or is that just maybe hearsay?
Well, I can't comment specifically on nose cancer. I can tell you that there has been links with air pollution and certain cancers, particularly lung cancer, because that is respiratory. There may be other cancers. I think the evidence isn't as substantial there. We're still kind of collecting data. There, as I mentioned, we do have access to a lot of technology, but the data isn't as good as we want. But, you know, there may be other sources of cancer, like esophageal cancer. But the strongest evidence we do have is on respiratory diseases and cardiovascular diseases. So this is your lung cancer, but then it can also be things like asthma or pneumonia, especially in children. There could also be pathways by which the particles can pass from your lungs to your bloodstream and also lead to heart attacks and strokes and heart disease. So that's where the most evidence is now. But it could possibly lead to other cancers as well. There's also emerging evidence that it may cross the blood-brain barrier and can affect cognition. And so things like Alzheimer's, dementia, also just focus. There's been some research in schools that students may not perform as well on tests on higher air pollution days. So it can really lead to a lot of other factors. There's even new evidence that it may contribute to diabetes. So while I don't have specifically nose cancer, there's a whole variety of other conditions. I think that's why this is such a major concern, is because of all the potential conditions that this can contribute to.
Interesting. It's interesting how it really does affect like almost the whole body. Not just, I guess, you know, lungs seems very, I guess, obvious, but you know, the brain, diabetes, I wouldn't expect that. And it does show, as you're saying, how important it is to improve our air quality when we're cooking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So how can we, you know, sort of use education and awareness to promote, you know, improved health and improved cooking methods?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's multiple ways to answer that. I think first, because some of our research has focused on education, as I mentioned, we typically work in low middle income countries. So I think you can educate people on the health benefits. In some cases, that will help. As I mentioned, though, sometimes, you know, people may prefer the taste of food on one stove or only have access to that one stove. And so if you tell them, oh, it's, you know, better to cook with gas than with wood, they may be so focused on being able to feed their families that day that that's just not something they could be concerned with. They're focused on just being able to have enough food that if we say, oh, this will protect, you know, reduce your chance of lung cancer in 40 years, they don't have, you know, that type of, you know, privilege to think about that. So I think, you know, there is that idea of education. I think something too that our group at Liverpool is trying to focus on more also is looking at like recipes and different ways we can facilitate use of gas, whether that be like giving them access to pressure cookers and other things that are more efficient at cooking, and maybe recipes they can cook on those different technologies. So I think that's the way that education can come in use. But if you just tell them, you know, openly, oh, this is healthier for you, they may not have the means or the ability to do that. So I think education can only get you so far. You have to have the ability to actually be able to take that advice reasonably. In some cases, they're stressed with other things. But I think also, you know, education when it comes to household air pollution and ambient air pollution, like we talked about trying to advocate for electric stoves. There's been some states in the U.S., I think California, maybe also New York, that have kind of banned the use of new buildings, gas stoves in new buildings, and only focus on electric stoves. And so, you know, just educating people about the benefits of electric cooking, because some people may still not be aware. So that can also be beneficial. Or like we just talked about, maybe you just buy an induction stove, and that can also reduce, you know, your exposure. It may be hard because if you're cooking with gas, you may not actually experience any of these immediate effects like, you know, eyes burning or coughing. So we think, oh, it's fine. You know, my family cooked this way. But I think, you know, that education can also be important. And so, you know, when it got media coverage, that was a great opportunity to spread awareness of that. And I think there is, you know, increased kind of momentum in the area of household air pollution. I know myself, when I first started my research and my master's, I had no idea what household air pollution was. So it really does, you know, kind of go under the radar. We think about the health burden. And I mean, it's estimated, I think, about 3 million people die a year from household air pollution. So it's a huge concern, but yet kind of under, there's not enough awareness about that. So I think, you know, education is a big component to increase investment in ways to try to expand clean energy access.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, as I had no idea about, you know, gas. I mean, I think we also all intuitively know at least that, you know, sometimes smoke is not good for us. But I think I had no idea about, you know, how bad gas could be. When I moved in, I'm moving into this new place, and I was very excited actually because I was getting a gas stove finally. And I was like, oh, all the things I can cook with this gas stove now. And then all these, you know, articles came out about the health effects of gas. And I'm like, oh man, now I gotta go back to electric. But so it's good because now I know that I need to ventilate. I need to maybe invest in an induction stove. But are there any, like, you know, methods of cooking that are going to be affected by this? My thought is I really wanted to make baba ganoush, but I could never do it because I don't have the right equipment for it. You know, is there maybe a time and a place for these more traditional types of cooking methods?
Yeah, so I'm to be honest, I'm not entirely sure about how much the method itself can affect air pollution. My assumption would be that the method wouldn't be as important as the actual type of fuel. But I also wanted to first go back to your previous comment, because I agree that electric is a lot healthier than gas. And I think the nuance there, though, is that gas can be better at places where, as we mentioned, where electric isn't available. So in some cases, there is, I think, a place for gas and LPG. So I think we shouldn't, I think, completely abandon gas stoves. I think it should be a priority in lower middle income countries where that may be the safest option. But yeah, I totally agree that it's great that this got coverage. Because now we know, a lot of people didn't know. And as you said, people enjoy cooking with gas because, you know, they think it tastes better. Chefs love cooking with gas. You know, so that's totally very common. And I think, yeah, the methods, you know, I think there has to be some variability, but I think as long as you're cooking with electricity, it wouldn't be as bad. And of course, that also depends on, you know, if you're planning to cook with used gas stoves because of the taste, then that may be something you prefer. But as I mentioned, to kind of reduce the amount of time there, so maybe if you kind of let it simmer or cook, you're not kind of huddling over the stove or just like reading a book right in front of it, that would probably also minimize your exposure. But I think it would be most important, as much as possible, for as many meals as you can, to use electric. And if occasionally, you know, you think it would taste better on gas, I think, you know, that's fine. We don't know, you know, for sure how, you know, whether it's short-term exposure can have the impact it has. But I think, you know, the goal should be to minimize your overall exposure to air pollution, both in your home and out of your home.
It's funny because your recommendation to not linger around the stove is very sensible, but also reminds me of when we were kids, we were told not to be near the microwave as it was heating things up.
Yeah.
And I feel like maybe we switched around a bit now.
Yeah, no, exactly. So yeah, I think that's also, and sometimes we say like, don't be by the fire because of fear of actually, you know, getting burned, but maybe the actual fear is the emissions and not the actual burn. I think the emissions are can be affecting a lot more people. Yeah.
Thank you. And so how, what kind of impact does, you know, lowering household air pollution, what kind of impact does that have on, you know, climate change and, you know, environmental improvements?
Yeah. So there's been some research in this area as well. So the estimates that I've seen are that I think about 2% of global emissions of CO2 or CO2 equivalents come from cooking or just overall household energy. And the main component, so there's a component of PM2.5 called black carbon or soot. And this is kind of this dark material. And that is a very strong climate forcing pollutant. I think it's, I don't remember the exact number in my head. I want to say like 100 or 1,000, many orders of magnitude more stronger, warmer than CO2 itself. It does last in the atmosphere a lot shorter than CO2. So what that means is that we can see faster improvements if we dramatically reduce household air pollution because black carbon doesn't last as long in the atmosphere and it's such a strong climate forcing agent. So we think of black carbon, we think of, for example, if you have snow and it's darker, that you're actually absorbing more of the heat. So that black soot is actually absorbing more of the UV radiation is what's heating up the atmosphere. And so that is a common pollutant from the inefficient burning of fuels. And so there's been some research showing that, you know, black carbon is emitted from cooking with wood and charcoal and these other polluting fuels at a much higher level than LPG. And there's no black carbon from electric cooking. So we can have an immediate impact on climate if we can do a dramatic shift to these clean energy sources. So there definitely would be some climate impacts that we should everyone from electricity, in some cases, to electricity and LPG.
Great. It's great to know that, you know, is this possibility to make such a big improvement, particularly as we all get a bit scared with climate change.
Exactly. Yeah, it's definitely here. And we're seeing, I think, the effects more and more every year when it comes to natural disasters and wildfires. So yeah, I think more investment really is needed to accelerate this growth. And I think that's something, you know, we keep coming back to with air pollution. I think it's really underinvested and there's still not enough awareness about the severity issue. But yeah, if we can really scale it up, we have the ability to improve health and climate.
And, you know, so I think, you know, a lot of our listeners, you know, or myself, I live in quite a privileged position. You know, I have the opportunity to use electric rather than gas. But if I want to make more of an impact, maybe assist with people who are going from that solid fuel to the gas, what can I do to help with this? Is it just voting? Can I support specific companies?
Yeah, I always advocate for voting. So if you find that there's politicians where you live that are more aligned with climate positive policies, definitely voting is a strong way, not just for household air pollution, but for any type of climate action. So that's always an important way that everyone should be involved in for every issue. So definitely that's a way you can be involved. I also think, so there are some organizations that are devoted specifically to this cause. One of them is the Clean Cooking Alliance with the United Nations Foundation. So there are probably opportunities to donate with them. And that organization funds a lot of research and invests in these startup companies that are trying to accelerate access to a variety of technologies. In some cases, it is gas and different other financial modalities to make the gas cheaper so people can afford it. Also scaling up electric cooking. In some cases, there's these improved biomass stoves, which some companies are trying to expand as well to lower emissions, which we need more data on that. But I think the these organizations like Clean Cooking Alliance and also other just global development organizations like USAID, which is a big international development company in the US, and a lot of other global health organizations, even EPA. They all like fund different research and also can sometimes fund, invest in these companies. So I think considering donating to some of those organizations or even visiting their websites and looking at what the research they're doing if you want to try to get involved. So if you look into Clean Cooking Alliance, for example, they're part of the United Nations Foundation. They have a ton of research. It's kind of a central repository. Also, World Health Organization is also very involved. They have a team looking into household air pollution. There's a lot of data there. And also, I know we're going to talk about this at the end, but if listeners want to get more involved than just a donation, they can also feel free to contact me, and I'm happy to be a resource. I think that's a great, we're happy to have as much help as we can. So there is definitely a lot of organizations. I think it's really expanded, I would say, even the last like 5 years since I started. I remember when I first started, there was not a lot of momentum. And I think now with a lot of other financial incentives, like these carbon credits and other mechanisms, there's a lot more startups being in that are generating different technologies, and we need the monitoring and evaluation. So that's a lot of the research that I do, my colleagues do, to try to evaluate what is the health and climate impact. So there's plenty of ways to get involved, and we definitely welcome anyone to join us.
Great, thank you so much. It's good to know that there are ways that we can help and, you know, support really good initiatives.
Yeah, of course.
So we know that, you know, outdoor air pollution can also be really, really important to our health. I was in Vietnam recently, in Hanoi, and I was like, why does it always smell like smoke here? And I was Googling it. Apparently it's got like maybe the second worst air pollution, in Asia, in the world. I'm not sure, but so I'm assuming that that would have a huge impact on people's health, you know, to the point that, you know, is there even any point in fixing our indoor health, indoor air pollution, because the outside air pollution is also going to affect us. So, you know, is it worth it? Is there a difference? Can you explain a bit more about indoor and outdoor pollution?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. So a lot of the epidemiological studies we conduct in various communities, and interestingly, there's been a variety of levels of effectiveness. And we think a portion of that could be due to levels of ambient air pollution. So we know that if you're cooking indoors, especially if you have windows open, that doesn't only stay indoors, that air pollution can go anywhere, and the same vice versa. So if there's outdoor air pollution, that could also percolate into your home. So if you have your window open and you live near a busy intersection, that air pollution can go into your household as well if you have areas for it to enter. And so we think about different interventions if we're trying to reduce household air pollution. For example, in sub-Saharan Africa, a lot of times there can be episodes of Sahara dust. And so you can imagine that if you're reducing someone's household air pollution level by providing them with gas or electric, if they were cooking with charcoal or wood, if they go outside for many times of the day, either to work or their children to school, they can be exposed to high levels of ambient air pollution. And so their overall PM2.5 exposure can still be very elevated, to the point that household air pollution may not be their main source of exposure. And in that case, I think the effectiveness would not be as high because they're still getting a high level. And so if you're reducing their household air pollution, that's still not their main exposure source. So it wouldn't be as effective, like you said, when you were in Vietnam. But if you're in, let's say, maybe a more rural area where the ambient air pollution is low, and household air pollution is the main source, then that could be much more effective. You may see greater health impacts. And I think the other important aspect of this is that if you're thinking about a village, if everyone's cooking with wood, but you provide one household with gas, there could be that overall community level plume of smoke, that even if one person is cooking with gas, their neighbors are still cooking with wood or charcoal. And so their exposures may still be pretty high. And so it really does greatly depend on the context. We've seen this with measurements where some interventions have been a lot more effective at others. It tends to be more effective in rural areas. That's a very general statement, but obviously depends locally because air pollution can vary at very small scales. It also depends on how often the person is traveling outside, how close they are to roads. So yeah, there's definitely a need to address both. So we talk about addressing house air pollution. I think there also needs to be ways to tackle ambient air pollution, especially in low middle income countries, if we think about more regulations, because some of these countries don't have regulations or monitoring as much. So I think that's also why we need to increase efforts to improve outdoor air pollution too.
And how can we improve outdoor air pollution?
Yeah, so it's really a variety of sources. So in some cases, especially in like the US and Australia, the main sources can be from traffic. So if we think about expanding electric vehicles, that's one way. Also, you know, reducing the amount of fossil fuels we burn. So if we think about shutting down coal-fired power plants and switching to solar, those are main sources. But then where you mentioned when you were in Vietnam, there can also be open burning, whether that's, you know, agricultural crop fields just burning. And so that's something that can be a main source. And so reducing that, it really depends on the location you're in. Even sometimes just burning of trash if there's not solid waste management. So sometimes we put our waste in landfills or incinerators, but if there's no plan there, some people can just openly burn their trash outside their homes, which can also be another source. And so it matters to reduce all of those sources wherever you are. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So some of it's personal, you know, maybe walking, taking the train or using an electric car over maybe driving. But for some, it's maybe more policies, having a mechanism to remove rubbish rather than burning it. And that's more of a government thing. So I guess your point about voting is really important there.
Yes, definitely. So it can all be done at a personal level. It can also be done at a community level and also, yeah, large country government level. So yeah, there's a variety of factors. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But that's unfortunately something that, you know, we have a bit of control over, but, you know, sometimes we don't necessarily have control. And particularly in Australia a few years ago, we had our bushfires. Now, the government can't control bushfires, unfortunately, but it did affect air quality a lot. So, you know, in these situations where you cannot control the air pollution, what is a practice that you can do to reduce your exposure to air pollution outside?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And before I even answer that, I wanted to first say that the reason why air pollution is such a large global problem is because everyone's breathing in air, right? So it's something where, you know, these bushfires, they're affecting everyone. It's not like, oh, you're smoking, so it reduces, you know, it increases your chance of lung cancer. Everyone's breathing in this air. So because, you know, the whole population of, you know, 7 billion people about is breathing in this air, that's why it can be so detrimental to health when we have potentially millions of deaths a year, is because it's a huge exposure. Everyone is breathing in this pollution. I think WHO estimates that 99% of the world is living above recommended levels. So it's really almost everyone is breathing in this polluted air. And so that's why it's such a major issue, is because, you know, when it gets to that level, you can't really control it. However, to answer your question, there are some personal things you can do. So one would be, if it is an extreme event, like you're in a wildfire, bushfires, to definitely limit your time outside. So remain indoors if you can, close all windows, doors, so to not let the smoke get in. If you do have to go outside, you know, wear the mask, you know, those N95 masks, something strong like that, that can reduce your exposure. We mentioned air purifiers in your home can be useful to help reduce the levels in your house. And then even when it comes to periods where it's not an actual extreme event, like a wildfire, if you happen to be running or cycling, to maybe try to take a less busy street, if you're cycling to work, let's say, so maybe go through a neighborhood or a less, rather than biking, you know, on busy street. And sometimes you may not be able to, depending on whether it's bike lanes. But you know, if you're walking, what I try to do is tend to avoid busy streets, also because of noise. In general, but I think, you know, if you want to just reduce your air pollution, it may sound silly, but if you think about me, I live in the city of Boston, I don't have a car, so I walk everywhere. You know, I try to sometimes go in less busy streets, you know, where there's maybe less buses and things like that. So especially if you're running, because the amount of air you're breathing in is higher. So it's nice to run in a park or somewhere where you're not next to a busy street, because the something that may be you know, not as healthy as if you are going for runs every day or every other day and you're running, you know, next to a busy street or a highway or something like that. That would not be recommended. So to try to find more green space for those activities. Yeah.
And that's really great advice. And I'm glad to hear that me avoiding people by not running on the main roads has been doing me good.
Yeah, exactly. You could just say you're doing it for health reasons, not because of avoiding people. Yeah.
Yeah. I just really just like having to dodge people.
Yeah, that too. That's another extreme movement.
Yeah. So we'll move on to the open mic now. So this is where you get to talk about something that you're passionate about. And it doesn't have to be related to our topic, but I do believe it's going to be related. So what would you like to talk about today?
Yeah, so I think it, thanks for this opportunity, first of all, to have a few minutes. Yeah, so it will be related to this because I think it's important and something we don't have as much time to discuss. I think I might have mentioned it briefly at the beginning, but something we phrase in the research world as kind of co-benefits. So we mentioned health and climate, but there's these other benefits to clean energy access, especially when it comes to women, because typically in low-middle income countries, women are often tasked with cooking. Primarily, and also if their children are close by. So the benefits firstly can be women's empowerment. So one aspect we didn't really talk about, but you're cooking with wood, it's not something that's piped to your household like we have, it's readily available. You actually have to go into a forest or you know, travel. In some cases, it could be hours, especially with deforestation. And if you're in a rural area, it could take a long time. And so that's something we refer to sometimes as time poverty. But you can imagine if you're spending hours per week or an hour per day, that takes away valuable time you could be doing anything else, whether that's even resting or, you know, if you're a child going more time in school, for the main cook, she could have more time to work and more earn income or care for her children. And so you could imagine, you know, millions of people and having this time poverty of having to gather their fuel almost on a daily basis. And the same goes for, you know, fetching clean water. This also applies to fuel. So that is something that takes away from possible educational opportunities or income generating opportunities, which can lift people out of poverty. So that's something that's, I think, very important. And sometimes we don't think about that. But, you know, there's been some research that it's kind of emerging because this hasn't been as common as just air pollution, but that people will actually earn additional income. So if you provide them with a clean stove, they may even, for example, cook more meals and sell it in the market. So a lot of people may work in the informal sectors. So they don't have a formal job. A lot of their job is, as I mentioned, these food street vendors or just selling food. So they may say, oh, I had more time because one, I don't have to gather the fuels. I have my gas or my electricity right here. And I could also cook faster because I can control the flame. And so I cooked, you know, extra food and then I sold it in the market. Or now I have more time to go food shopping and I bought more food in the market. My family isn't as hungry. And so their food security improves as well. And so that can improve their nutrition. Something else as simple as, oh, maybe now I have a two burner gas stove or electric stove. So I can cook two meals at once or two different side dishes at once. And I'm increasing the diversity in my food, which is also good from a nutritional standpoint, because now you're consuming, you know, more variety and getting more nutrients. And you could also cook faster, right? And so then maybe you have more time, maybe just heat up the meal. Next time, you don't have to worry about gathering the wood. And so you could think about cumulatively over time. This is like on a daily basis, people eating more diversity, larger quantity, because maybe they can afford it now, you know, and also just the time. So these are these benefits that can really have an impact on generating more income, which I think is ultimately allowing these families to empower themselves, lift themselves out of poverty. They may be able to get additional income, as I mentioned, and then that can maybe provide more income for their children to go to school or, you know, healthcare costs. So I think these are these other, as I mentioned, the term co-benefits that are sometimes overlooked, whether it be income, food security, food diversity. And so some of the research that I'm hoping to conduct is along these lines. So I predominantly focus, as I mentioned, my research on air pollution and measuring that with air monitors. But then what if we can also measure these co-benefits? I think it's challenging because it's not as standard as measuring someone's air quality. You know, you actually have to maybe ask surveys. You can't really say, okay, you know, like how well did your food security improve? You have to measure that using standardized tools. So I think the research hasn't been as strong because it is more challenging. And there's a lot of work in our field to kind of standardize this. So how can we get researchers and organizations to measure this across the same way so we could do a comparison of the impacts? And also, you know, these effects may take a while. Like you may see, you know, this improvement, but how long until you can have a measurable impact on education or income? But the one thing I will say, because I have done a little bit of research on this in Kenya predominantly, is that this is something that's immediately felt by households. So if you say, you know, okay, I got this stove and now I have suddenly an extra hour a day, you notice that immediately because people are very aware of their time. And also their additional income is something they can also be aware of almost instantaneously. Like now I have more time, I made more income. And so these benefits are actually something that families may register more than, say, a long-term impact on a reduction on lung cancer, because that they may not actually affect them on their day-to-day. But having the improved income, they can feed their families better tomorrow and their children aren't as hungry. And that's something they immediately witness. And I think that can be a stronger motivation for encouraging use of these fuels than just education on the health impact. So I think having this tailored message about these benefits that have an immediate impact on improving their health, which also can reduce their stress of having to worry about food every day and just their physical and mental well-being. I think those are things that we need to increasingly think about, and something I'm personally trying to spread awareness about through my research and conducting more studies. And so I think that is where our area of research is going, is more on generating these co-benefits beyond just health and climate, especially when it comes to women, because I mentioned they're predominantly tasked with this. And so we talk about gender equality. And this is, I think, one critical way to help, you know, billions of women that are still cooking with these fuels. And so this is, I think, a great opportunity to have these other benefits. And the great thing is, if you're trying to improve air quality, these are just co-benefits that naturally happen. It's not like you have to spend extra. The stove can handle a lot of these things. And so that's something else that we need to document with these metrics. And we can maybe quantify that in a measurable amount. So what is the reduction in healthcare costs or improvement in nutrition? How can we monetize that and incentivize other companies to invest in these clean technologies to increase the speed? Because as we know with climate change, nothing is happening fast enough. And so this is one area where we can really have a dramatic impact on livelihoods as well.
I had no idea that, you know, clean air and cooking fuels could make such an impact on so many different areas of life. That's amazing. And you also mentioned that it can help with mental well-being. How does clean air and you know, the fuels we're using for cooking, how does that affect mental well-being?
Yeah, so there are a couple of potential mechanisms. One is through the air pollution itself. So there may be certain pathways, like via inflammation in the body, that it may actually affect your mood, possibly depression. So though the research is preliminary on that, so I can't say for sure, but there are potential ways that the air pollution itself can contribute to poor mental health. So if you can imagine reducing household air pollution, that may improve mental health. And some of the research I've done is actually on this other aspect of just clean energy access itself. So having less time, requiring less time to travel to gather fuel wood. And so you feel like it's less labor intensive. You find you have more time to relax. Also, there's risk sometimes of injury. If you can imagine carrying this wood on your back, on your head, carrying all these fuels every day, you can have that risk of injury, which can also, you know, have affect mental well-being. In some cases, unfortunately, especially in refugee camps, there could be issues with sexual violence or harassment if a woman's traveling alone far off to gather fuel wood, which is another source of mental distress. So all of these cumulative factors, I think, factor in. And you can imagine just having the stove available eliminates that, right? Because you have to travel an hour or more a day. So I think those components may also improve mental well-being. So it's also kind of multifactorial. And the research is still ongoing, but as more comes out, we may see that this is a contributing factor to many of those sources that can contribute to poor mental health.
Wow, that's, certainly hits so many different areas of our lives. That's, amazing. Thank you for doing this research so that we can learn about this and so we can improve everyone's lives. And if people want to find out more about you and your work, where can they find you?
Yes, so they can find me on Twitter, or I guess X as it's called now. So I'm at Matt, M-A-T-T underscore Shup, S-H-E-P. So I post some of my research there. You can also check my research group at University of Liverpool. So our group is called Clean Air Africa. So we're on Twitter as well as at Clean Air Africa. There's a website, cleanerafrica.com, where we post a lot of our research. That's another great source as well. As I mentioned, you could also email me if anyone has specific questions about anything I've covered. So one of my emails is m.shupler@liverpool.ac.uk. You can also reach me on Twitter. And you could also reach out to our group as well. So we're at the University of Liverpool. And as I mentioned, there's a variety of other stakeholders involved, like the Clean Cooking Alliance, UN Foundation, if you want to get involved. So feel free to use any of those methods.
Great. Thank you so much. And we'll make sure we put those in the show notes so everyone can find you nice and easy. So thank you so much for talking to me today. I had no idea that clean air was so important, not just for our lungs and for our health, but also for women and empowering women and also for our mental well-being. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you, Gabrielle, and everyone on this podcast for allowing me to share my research and disseminate all this information. So I really appreciate this opportunity. It was great to speak with you.
You've been listening to On the House, produced by the Household Management Science Labs, a division of LMSL, the Life Management Science Labs. More episodes like this from across 10 life management perspectives can be found by searching LMSL on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, YouTube, Spotify, and other podcasting apps available on your smart devices. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider rating our show, sharing it, and subscribing to our channel, as it helps other people find it so we can grow and bring you more quality resources. More of our work can be found on our website at hm.lmsl.net, where you can join our movement. I'm Gabriella Yastra. Thanks for tuning in.